I admit it. The first night there was preseason action in the National Hockey League, I was watching telecasts. And it's different now. You get to watch all the preseason action from around the National Hockey League. Darren Millard, John Shannon.
I watched you.
Did you tune in?
I watched you.
Yes.
You got to be on the road. Holy smoke.
Yes, in San Jose.
Pretty exciting.
Vegas played San Jose three times out of their seven preseason games, twice in 5 days in San Jose.
Okay, so you're gonna play three times. The challenge for anybody is there'll probably be 45 different sharks you're gonna have to learn about.
Yeah,
over for three games.
Gosher, our play-by-play voice. The very talented and esteemed Dave Gosher. He's doing four of our seven games because we move people around during the preseason just to make sure.
Are you doing a play-by-play?
If something ever happens. No, I'm not. I just do the rookie tournament, which is fun. But Gosher's doing four games. Three of them are against San Jose.
Oh, my God.
He's like, when I get to the season, I'm not going to know what to do.
He'll be the voice of the Sharks.
But the interesting thing is, next year, teams are limited to four games total. Mm-hmm. And in looking at this and talking to different people, it's the impact of it is it's great for veteran players. It is. The impact of it is the guys that are trying to break through and catch the coach's eye, and some guys need to play games. It's not just practice or scrimmages. They need to play the actual games. It's going to be much harder for them to make a statement in training camp with only four preseason games per team.
Well, that was the compromise made in order to get to 84 regular season games. But are you happy that they're adding two games that count versus two or three that don't?
Look, John, it's the same number of games for us, basically. Sure. We're moving two over, so it's great. Yeah, the fact that they count means more for everybody. The fans, the broadcaster, the players, it does. But just that guy that's trying to turn pro, play in the American Hockey League, and break through and get games in the NHL, it's hard to be that next call-up guy mm-hmm. on the depth chart if you haven't had the opportunity to play in more preseason games, which you're not going to get a chance to now.
When's Mitch Marner play?
Don't know for sure. We play Tuesday, Thursday at home, and then Friday on the road. He's not going to play that Friday game on the road, I don't believe. So it'll be either tomorrow night or Thursday when they will go in.
So the Jets have already announced Jonathan Toews is going to play Tuesday night in Winnipeg. So, Toews actually wanted to play all six games of the preseason. He just wants to get into game action.
I don't blame him there.
I surmised tomorrow night might be the only game that every veteran guy wants to play, because I think you'd want to be in the lineup when Jonathan Toews is in the lineup. Wouldn't you think?
Yes. And then big picture, it's a meaningless game.
I know,
you're going to play a lot with them.
But it's the first time, and you know it's going to be an event in Winnipeg on Tuesday night when Jonathan Toews skates onto the ice in a Jets sweater. You know, something that as you talked about with Mark on Friday has been a dream of a lot of people in Winnipeg for a long period of time.
Will that game be sold out, do you believe?
You know, they had 14,000.
It's a great marketing idea. Promotional to tell everybody ahead of time, look, Toews is going to play.
I would hope it would be.
It's rare that a preseason game grabs attention like that.
They had 14,000 yesterday afternoon for their first game against Minnesota. So I would suspect that Tuesday night, tough night to sell hockey tickets, but the fact that Jonathan Toews, the local legend, is playing, I wouldn't be surprised if they're sold out.
You know what? One thing that I'd like to get rid of now that we've pared down the preseason,
mm-hmm.
split squads.
Oh yeah,
we don't do it in Vegas, thankfully. But I'd like to get rid of.
It's funny you were mentioning about the fact in the future only four exhibition games or preseason games, But the NFL, you know, the coaches have worked around it. Now they have practices against other teams, yes. Right? I wonder if we're going to see something like that, or even if it's allowed under the CBA to have a practice game Tuesday afternoon, no people, in order to try to figure that out. I mean, you know as well as I do, managers and coaches are going to try to find loopholes, aren't they?
Well, yeah. It's no fitness testing. You don't think they're going to find a way to make sure or evaluate what kind of shape everybody's in?
As long as it's not the broadcasters, we're okay. So
there's I watched a couple of coaches did have some drills without pucks around the league. And Bruce Cassidy doesn't do that here. Everything's just structured different. But at times, the old person in me, it's like, ooh, I don't mind seeing the guys just skating. It's kind of mean of me to say that.
Yeah, it is. But you're a goalie, and you know you always used to cheat on drills. Goalies cheat on drills.
Oh my goodness, those skating drills! Oh, not even close to the same number of miles that the other guys are doing. Exactly. Hey, John Davidson's going to join us. The passing of Bernie Parent on the weekend, which follows our loss of Ken Dryden, Eddie Jockeman. It's been a terrible few weeks for that era of goaltending. But Bernie Parent, what was your first memory of the little goalie?
Well, it's going to sound strange, but I didn't know he was that good a goalie until he came back from the WHA. He was a guy that had played and was one of the first guys he signed with the Miami Screaming Eagles, Darren.
Then they went bankrupt, right?
Well, they moved to Philadelphia, became the
Blazers.
Philadelphia Blazers, and so Bernie played the 1 year, and then had, you know, the Flyers were so mad he got traded to Toronto. Actually, let's wait. I'll tell the story with JD because it's fascinating, because I think that the trade to Toronto changed Parent's career, because I think before Toronto, and reasons why, he was a good goalie. I think after Toronto and after the WHA, he was a great goalie. And there's a reason for that. There really is a reason for that.
He's my first favorite goaltender. I've got his replica mask here in the home office of 100% Hockey and a marvelous personality, but the fastest feet with skate saves, which nobody makes anymore. Why would you? But he had such fast feet and Conn Smythe Trophy winner, back to back. And everybody talks about the big, bad Philadelphia Flyers, the Broad Street Bullies. Goaltending might have been the best part of that team, with all due respect to everything else.
He was the first goalie, as I recall, you were never surprised his goals against average was under two.
But never didn't play internationally.
197. Well, remember, Canada was in a bit of a hiatus internationally. You know, 19. You know, didn't play any in Olympics in 72. Didn't play. You weren't putting Parent in 1972 because it was of the WHA stuff. You weren't putting him in front of Dryden and Cheevers. And
76 was already filled.
This was Rogie.
Yeah.
You know, so it was his timing to be an international star. And let's face it, international hockey. It's totally different now than it was, and with the respect for international hockey, is totally different now than it was in the 70s, for sure.
I've got a selfie picture with him on my wall outside in the living room with a signed picture of Bernie, but the selfie came from an amazing moment, interaction with him, which I will share later in the program, and it's something you can't make up, and he came up to me and asked me a question, and we both laughed about it at the end, but I was like, what is Bernie Parent asking me? So I'll share that with you. But first, we get to John Davidson coming up on 100% Hockey with Millard and Shannon. It's one of our favorites, John Davidson joining us. And today we're going to talk about the past a little bit more. It's been a really difficult time, especially for your era. Your thoughts on Bernie Parent, and when you found the news yesterday of his passing.
I, you know, the last time I saw Bernie was was at the Johnny Gaudreau funeral in Philadelphia. And it was a very solemn place. It was a fairly large with a lot of people. And I was sitting with my wife and our team, and I get a tap on the shoulder, and it was Bernie. This guy is one of the nicest people I've ever met. He was, first of all, he's a hell of a goaltender. I mean, that's to be said. But for the kind man that he was, and always with a smile, and always saying hello, and always reminiscing about the battles we had, et cetera, it's sad. It really is. Then you look, he's 80 years old. You look at Eddie Jackman, he was 86, I think. Time's flying by, and maybe I'm not realizing it as much as I should be. These are good people, really good people. And to, as they say in life, Father Time is undefeated, and he wins again. So it's tough, but the memories are good. I can say that.
Some of us do remember watching Bernie Parent play. Yeah. And for a rather small period of time, Bernie Parent was at the pinnacle of goaltending. What made him so special as a goalie, John?
I think he was strong-willed in the net, for one, John. And he may be one of the last great stand-up goaltenders. He very seldom was down. It was weird because his pads were small. They were hardly above his knees. Right. But he was challenging. He was smart. He knew how to play. He made the big saves. He was loved by his teammates, and that always is very, very helpful when you play that position. You know, if you work hard and you take one for the team and you battle and you make big saves at big times, your teammates love you and they'll do anything for you. And he was one of those guys. He was all in, but it was amazing. Sometimes with myself at the other end of the ice, I'd be flopping all over the place. And there he was, just standing up, going side to side. Sometimes in goaltending, there's a saying, less is more. You don't have to make every save look like it's a 10-beller or a spectacular save. Sometimes just move a little bit and it hits you. I figured that out in my last training camp. Bernie did it from day one. He was good.
1974, 1975, he won the Conn Smythe. They won the Stanley Cup. Yeah. They were known as the Broad Street Bullies. Which was more and a more intimidating factor, Bernie Parent's goaltending or just the way that Fred Shiro had the team play?
I think it was a combination because I know when I was with the Rangers then and we went into Philadelphia, the old Spectrum, I mean, those really were – they were really, really tough battles. And you better show up with intestinal fortitude or they run you right out of the rink. And if you got physical with one of their guys, 10 guys on their team would come after you, but you had to stick up for each other. And so from a goaltender's point of view, I think knowing Bernie was the other end and how well he played, that was good. But the intimidation factor of the Flyers back then was something. And that was all caused, by the way, by the St. Louis Blues. Mm-hmm. St. Louis Blues went into Philadelphia and smoked them a few times. And Ed Snyder, who was the owner, says, that ain't going to happen again. And he changed the structure. And the rest is history.
That's the Plager boys.
Yeah. And they deserved the reputation. They're great. I played with them. They were fantastic. Great, great, great teammates, great guys. And they had some real characters on that club.
It's a great bumper sticker back in the day. Only God makes more saves than Bernie Parent. Yeah. And for that stretch, it was pretty true. But what's amazing is, and we'll reminisce about Ken Dryden as well, but the Boston Bruins owned the rights to both Ken Dryden and Bernie Parent.
Yeah.
Out of the at the start of their careers.
Yeah. Yeah, imagine that. That's really something to speak of. And a lot of times, though, with goaltenders, you see them pop with their second or third team. It's mm-hmm. The rules are hard to keep people when they haven't hit it just yet. You can't leave them in the minors for too long like they used to be able to do. So it's changed, and that's understandable. But when you think of all the goaltenders we've lost within the last few months, you think of Greg Millen, who is, as you guys know, as good as it gets with a personality and a kind person. Wayne Thomas played in Toronto, Montreal, and he was my teammate, my partner in New York. And he had many years working with the with San Jose Sharks and did just a tremendous job there. One real quick story. Wayne was in rough shape living at the Cape near Boston. And I would talk to Wayne and talk to his wife. And the one thing that I learned, which was as classy as it gets, is Nabokov, the goaltender, who Wayne coached a lot, made a special trip up to Boston to see Wayne not too long before he passed. And those are the good things. Those are the good stories. And so those two, and then Eddie Jockman, who I played with a very short period of time. And
well,
really,
let's face it,
really
They traded for you to replace Eddie Jockman.
Yeah, Eddie was getting a little older. I was a kid, played 2 years in St. Louis. My first year was terrific. My second year, I was not very good. And they ended up moving me to New York. And they had Eddie Jockman and Joe Villemire. Another quick story there is I got a text from Pete Stemkowski, who was a teammate of all of ours in New York. He said, we've lost our goalie, Eddie. I go, huh? So I phoned Pete, and sure enough, he told me that, he got a note and that Eddie had passed away. What was ironic about it is that was the day of the Rangers alumni golf tournament. Pete was on his way to pick up Joe Villemire to take him up to Westchester County to go to the golf tournament. And they hear the news about Eddie passing away. So it's crazy. And last time I saw Eddie was in New York at Madison Square Garden, and he looked terrific. And in talking to his daughter, she said that he was doing real well. And then the end came real quick. And that was a very sad period of time for the family, obviously.
So yeah, you got to tell the story of you're playing for the Rangers and Eddie comes back to the Garden. With Detroit.
Yeah. Well, what happened was we were on an airplane flying somewhere for a game, and Frank Pace was the medical trainer, and he's standing at the back of the plane. In those days, you wandered around, talked to everybody. So I go to the back of the plane, and how you doing, Frankie? You all right? Because he looked sort of ashen. And he says, well, you didn't hear? I said, no, I didn't hear. What do you mean? I was, I think, 21 at the time. He said, Eddie's gone to Detroit on waivers. And I didn't know. I mean, oh, man, for me, that means I'm stepping into the position. That was it was shocking, to be honest. So sure enough, 2 days later, the first game at home that we have since Eddie's gone is Detroit with Eddie. And they come in, and I swear I have never seen in all my – oh, I did. In Chicago, the Gulf War had begun, and in Chicago Stadium, it was crazy. This is the only other time I've ever seen it as crazy as that. It was Madison Square Garden. Banners all over the place. We love you, Eddie. We're going to miss you, Eddie, et cetera, et cetera. And they went crazy, those fans, for Eddie Jockman. He stopped close to 50 shots. I did not. And we got beat. I can't remember the score, but it wasn't very flattering. And for Eddie, it was some night for him. And even our players, you could sense that it was hard for them to play against Eddie Jockman. So after the game, I'm a little shell-shocked. The place is, the hallway intersects with the two locker rooms, and I come out, and Eddie's standing there. He says, I want to talk to you. So I went over and talked to him. I'm telling you, he couldn't have been nicer. The class and the confidence he was trying to give me to do the job for the Rangers was really special, really special. This was his night, but he went out of his way to talk to me to look to the future and get the job done and go for it, and you can get it done, et cetera, et cetera. It was really quite special. And every time I've seen Eddie Jockman since, it's always been a great conversation. A classy guy as far as I'm concerned.
Would that interaction or that pep talk from a former teammate, now a rival, somebody who you took their job, would that be harder today, do you think?
I don't know about today as much because in those days, like I remember being in Boston and then heading to Atlanta for a big game for the Rangers to try to make the playoffs. And Jerry Cheevers came into the hallway and grabbed me because he knew that Phil Esposito was on our team and they were tight. And I was a real young goaltender. And, what he said was, you got to get in the game early. I said, well, I'm going to give him my best shot. He said, no, bump somebody. Put your arms up, smack them. It'll get your adrenaline going. That's what he told me to do. This is a lot of years ago, but yeah. I still remember these things. It was interesting, the goaltending union and how you sort of stuck together.
Did you play the guy at the other end? Did you have that internal matchup going when you played Bernie or Ken or Jerry or Eddie?
No, I was trying to. The Ken was a boy, was he good? He'd get 16, 18 shots, but two of them would be 3-on-1s or a breakaway, and he'd stop them all the time. He had a strong mental will. No, I loved the moments going into new arenas and playing against the other team's great goaltenders. It was just maybe being naive. I don't know. I just went and played. Ken was a geez. Was he good? Was he good? He went through a rough time too when we played them in the finals. I was with the Rangers. We end up playing Montreal in the finals in 1979, and the first game is in the Montreal Forum, and we win, and the fans are booing Ken. They're hard on him, real hard on him in Montreal. So we get out of there with the win. Game two, they're scheduled to start Bunny Larocque, who was a fine goaltender. Well, Dougie Risebrough, his teammate, catches him with a shot right between the eyes. Boom, in warm-up, and down he goes, and Ken goes back in. And so, well, this kind of changes things up a little bit. This is getting interesting. We go up 2-0 in game two in Montreal in the Forum with a bunch of kids. And we had, we did have Phyllis Pacito, Carol Vadney. They were kind of the veterans on the team. And we're up 2-0, and then they turned it on and they got us in that game. And Ken was back. He was back to himself. They beat us 4 straight. We lost in 5. One of them was an overtime at Madison Square Garden. But that was something to go through that range of emotions for the great Ken Dryden. But he recovered and battled and certainly got the job done for them. He was a great goaltender.
Going back to Bernie, the thing that fascinates me about Bernie is in passing away yesterday, Philadelphia is a huge sports town.
Yeah.
And the Flyers, and particularly those two teams, 74 and 75, are still revered 50 years later. So when Bernie Perrant passes away, he's mentioned in the same sentence as the greatest of Phillies, the greatest of Sixers, and the greatest of Eagles and the Flyers. And that to me is what's more impressive about what Bernie meant to the city of Philadelphia.
It was the same with Eddie Jackman too. I mean, there was the back page of the New York Post. It was all Eddie. And the stories about the game in particular that we talked about. But, you know, you go back to both those goaltenders. They played a little differently. Eddie was one of the first best puck-handling goaltenders. He was exciting. He was all over the place, handling the puck and moving it. Fans fell in love with it. And Bernie, he was just one of those stand-up goaltenders, top of the crease, stuttered, stepped back and forth to stop the puck all the time. But they became legendary. And hockey can do that. I think back in those days in the early 70s, et cetera, it was a mean, rotten, tough game. It was the fans would get so emotionally involved with almost every game because of how tough it was, and you remember your heroes, and you think of that team with Bernie Perrant, you have Bobby Clark, the Watson brothers, Billy Barber, the rifle, Reggie Leach. Nobody shot the puck harder than him. He scared the hell out of me. And a lot of them lived there for a long period of time. Bobby Clark's still there. He goes up to Flin Flon in the summer, loves to fish, but he spends his time there. Jimmy Watson's still there. Bernie was there for all his time. They love that place. And they're loved back too. Those were special teams. They really were.
And Bernie took an interesting route. Were you following that during the course of your career? Because he was the Toronto Maple Leafs, and then the World Hockey Association, and then just kind of plopped back into the Flyers.
Yeah. Well, he actually got traded to Toronto after signing with the Miami Screaming Eagles. Yeah. And so ownership in Philadelphia was so mad at him, and they wanted to get something for him. And they traded him to Toronto for Doug Favelle.
Yeah, Favvy.
And so really that was I'm not the goalie guru here on this panel, but you are. But one of the things that changed Perrant after that was he got to come to Toronto and play with Jacques Plante.
Right.
Yeah. So Jacques
Plante. They were similar, yeah.
Could you imagine – now, we revere those two guys for sure, but Plante and Perrant were your 1-2. In goal for the Maple Leafs in the early 70s for one season. And that really, in many ways, changed Bernie's career, because Plante was such a scientific goalie in his time. A little bit of a whack job, but he was a scientific goalie.
All goalies are. I have to admit it. Yeah, but you know, and you think about it with Bernie, I guess you could say in some ways he was scientific. His angles were perfect all the time. Just remarkable. And you didn't get the net too often for a rebound with that defense with McCrimmon. And that was a big, they were a mean group, just a mean group. Also, John, I think back in those days, a lot of times it was a longer, maybe because at one point in time there were fewer teams, but it took a long time to become a starting goaltender in the NHL. They used to say, goalies don't hit their stride till they're 28 years old. I know I was started when I was 19, but maybe I should have waited and played in the minors a little longer. Might have been better off for me, but the times changed. But
You talk about the depth chart in Boston. Eddie Johnson, Jerry Cheevers, and Bernie Parent was third. In the expansion draft, they had to lose a goalie.
Yeah. Well, plus they ended up bringing Eddie Johnson, came to St. Louis to mentor me. And after my first year, and he was great. We were roommates on the road. I was 20 years old. He was like 37. It was interesting hearing all the Boston stories. He grew up in Montreal. He had a lot of stories there. And he is one of the all-time greats, too. If you want to talk about a great person, wonderful hockey man, a lifer, it's Eddie Johnson, without question. He and Jerry Cheevers were just magical together.
More stories on the way as we continue on 100% Hockey with John Davidson with Millard and Shannon. You mentioned Wayne Thomas, and if memory serves correctly, Wayne Thomas was in the net that night that Bernie Parent got hurt with the stick through the eye with the fiberglass mask, just a flute play at the other end. You wore one of those masks. And that was one of the dangers. We always think puck through the mask, but a stick just popping into the eye hole.
I think you have it right behind you. No, at the other side.
There it is.
There it is, yeah.
There's the John Davidson mask right there.
That's the one, yeah. Yeah, it was, and there was no padding on the inside, nothing. That fiberglass was right up against your face. So when you got hit with a stick or a puck or whatever, it'd go, for a few seconds. And that was something. And there was no throat protector. I think we were nuts. I mean, I'm glad it changed. And Ken's brother had a lot to do with, Ken Dryden's brother, a lot to do with putting the cage on the mask itself, on the fiberglass mask, which became a lot more safe to play. Yeah, I think it was Walter Tkachuk's stick, that got into Bernie. And ironically, Walter ended up having an eye injury, and he had to retire because of the eye injury too. But you hate to see things like that, but it was tough. It was dangerous back then. The equipment. I remember we played the Flyers two games in a row, home and home. And the first one was in Philly. We got beat 4-2. Second one was in New York. We got beat 4-2. Empty netter. And I had somewhere around 103, 102 shots over the weekend. And so I showered up after the second game, lost both, and I'm walking by with a towel. I'm walking by the doctor, and he said, I want to talk to you. I says, Doc, I'm tired. He said, I want to talk to you. So he looks at my body, and we start counting the bruises on the arms and on the legs and all that. There was like 14, 15, 16 healthy bruises. And he says, I want to see you tomorrow. I says, why? I says, we got a day off. He says, well, I want to take a blood test and see if you're okay. So you shouldn't bruise like that. There's leukemia issues, things like that. I said, I'll come in and check it out, but this is normal. I'm just telling you, this is normal. We beat up. Our equipment was not anywhere near what they have today. And at that point in time, the shots we're getting through Bobby Hull, et cetera, were getting a lot tougher, a lot higher, a lot more force. Reggie Leach would be one. And your body just got beat up. You had to deal with it. That's just how it was. It wasn't even practice. It was playing real games with these guys that could really shoot it.
We don't maybe give the Ranger-Flyer rivalry the respect it deserves. We always, in 2025, we talk about obviously the Battle of Alberta. We talk Toronto-Montreal, Islanders-Rangers. But there was a time Flyers-Rangers was crazy, wasn't it?
Oh, absolutely. No question about it. I remember when the Flyers had won the Cups and Fred Shiro, their coach, came to the Rangers. And we ended up having to give the Flyers a first rounder. That first rounder became Ken Linsman, the Rat, and who was a terrific player. And so the first exhibition game at Madison Square Garden the following fall was against the Philadelphia Flyers. And one of the players playing for us was the guy that became the referee, Paul Stewart. And he's going to play for us in that game. And he must have bought, I don't know how many tickets for all his family and everything. Anyway, the game starts. It's a Pier 6. It's in front of the Rangers bench. Everybody's going after each other. They're mad at the Flyers are really upset that that Freddie Sherrill left them and came to the hated Rangers. And we loved Freddie, and he was our coach that got us to the Stanley Cup Finals. But anyway, Paul Stewart got tossed about a minute and a half in after buying all those tickets for his family. And that was something else. Oh, those games were tough. They were really tough. Going into the Spectrum, the fans were right on the glass and yelling, throwing stuff at you, warm up. And Madison Square Garden was no peach either. I mean, they knew how to voice their opinion on a lot of different things with the Philadelphia Flyers. Personally, I loved it. It reminded me of playing junior hockey in Western Canada. When I played in Calgary for a team called the Centennials, we had to go play the Edmonton Oil Kings or the New West Bruins, who were bigger than the Atlanta Flames. They were giants. Yeah. And then we had to go into a Medicine Hat with Lanny McDonald and Tommy Lysiak and Brad or Big Grizz McCrimmon and Gassoff, Bobby Gassoff. They were tough, man. These were battles. So when I got into the NHL, when we had games like that, I kind of was used to it. I kind of liked it. It made you really get into it. Your adrenaline flow and you're nasty and you're all everything going. It was fun. It was great.
You just tweaked me to two of the great characters of the game in a playoff series, coach Rangers Flyers, McCammon versus Brooks. And that was when Herbie dubbed the Rangers the Smurfs, right?
That's when Bob McCammon called us the Smurfs.
Oh, so Bob McCammon called us, sorry.
Yeah. We were playing an exhibition game. I think it was Atlantic City. And the benches were together with a piece of glass in between. And Bob McCammon, you guys know, I mean, he was a riot. He was funny. He was he just yippity yappity yap, and then Herbie be walking up and down looking at him and everything else. So it's an exhibition game. So McCammon's going after our guys. So I stood up and I leaned against the glass, made myself as big as possible so McCammon couldn't see the other end of the ice. I was leaning out over the glass and he couldn't see our bench, and he starts on me. And then I turned to him and I went, and he looks at me and I says, "That's a hell of a goddamn horse's blanket you're wearing for a sports coat." And his whole bench breaks up. He starts laughing. Oh, it was an exhibition game. But that's what we did back in those days. It was something else. you guys are jarring my memory here.
No goalie coaches then either.
No.
People would be surprised.
One, yeah. First one I had was in New York, and it was Wayne Thomas. After he retired, they kept him on as the goalie coach. And here, him and I, we used to drink beer together and go out and on the road and have some
that's
fun
coaching.
And have dinner.
That's good coaching.
Yeah. And then he's got me on the ice early, making me do all these goalie drills. He went on to be fantastic.
Yes.
He worked a lot with a guy by the name of Warren Strelo, who was with Washington and then went to San Jose. He was Herbie Brooks' goalie guy. And he and Wayne worked together, and Wayne became just really, really good at what he did. Really good. And those guys were valuable people as part of their teams. I remember Warren Strelo had I can't remember what goalie it was, but he kept losing his balance. And they kept working with him for different drills and this and that. And Warren was in the locker room late one afternoon. The players are all gone. And he took the skates, the goalie skates, and he figured they weren't as flat as they should be. They were just a little bit off. And that created the imbalance for the goaltender on the ice and why he was falling back all the time. You know, he had to find the answer, and he found it. He was a terrific. He was the 1980, I think the 1980 coach too.
Yeah,
with,
he was.
With the club. Yeah.
Yeah.
How did you guys improve your game and develop then and in the era of Bernie and Ken and Ed Jockman before? Like,
You just played. And if your partner had more experience than you, you'd talk things over, but you played. That's all you did was you just played, practiced and played. You know, back, the goalie coach thing, I often look at it and go, geez, I wish I had that 3 or 4 years earlier. I really do. And that would have really made a lot of difference.
How is it?
Just structurally how you play the game. Like, as I said earlier in the show, I was 27 or 28 years old when I figured out less is more, where I didn't have to go make that big save, go sliding and this and that, just move. Just subtle movements, and the puck ended up hitting me. And I figured that out late. And I watch kids now. I have a grandson that's a goalie here in St. Louis. He's been doing it for a year, and he's already made this double-A travel team. They were in Chicago for 4 games this weekend. They got 7 out of 8 points. But yeah, exactly. No, I stay away. I had to buy the equipment. But you know who he's had out with him a few times, work with him? Thomas Greiss, the former goaltender. Yeah, wow. He's here in St. Louis. Could you imagine being 9 years old and having Thomas Greiss out there?
Wow.
I mean, I was lucky to be able to tie my own skates.
Yeah. So when you were playing, the first big coach you had, Emil Francis, was an old goalie, but he played the position when it was totally different than when you.
Yeah,
so the coach wouldn't. I mean, who would talk to you? Anybody? My
junior coach was a guy. He's famous back in Calgary, Scotty Monroe, sure. Tough as nails. That was one thing about junior hockey back then out west, was the coaches in each city that. Ernie McLean, Wild Bill Hunter up in Edmonton. They had Cement Shoes Benny Haskin in Winnipeg. Patty Janelle up in Flin Flon. It was remarkable with all those guys. But the big thing back then, and he used to yell at me, "Stay on your feet. Don't fall down. You look like drilled it. Other than that, that was it." That was it.
Do you think they actually thought that? Well, they thought that was better, but do you think they actually knew that was better, or it was just stay in
your
feet?
That's just the way it was back in those days. Yeah, back in those days, that's just what it was. And nowadays, heck, with the video, and you're able to watch other goalies play, and the way they all handle a puck. Now, even the European goaltenders come in and handle the puck pretty good now compared to back in the day when there was no chance. So it's been a remarkable change over the last, it's been a long time too, but, it's good. I think really good goalie coaches are invaluable. I'd even have more than one per organization. I'd have one that would go travel and scout goalies all over the world. You know, it's that important. You find that one guy.
Departments are big. More teams have them.
Benoit Allard in New York, all those years. Look at all the goalies he's had over the years. Mm-hmm. And even the ones that were not stars but good goalies, he made every single one of them better. Every one of them. And you hear them later in their careers say, boy, did he ever help me? You know, because when you can get that extra 2 or 3 or 4 years in your career, that's a lot of money in the bank to stake your future.
Well, you get a business. They become an asset for you, too.
Absolutely. Get something back for it. Trade value, yeah, sure. But, I mean, you think of their goaltenders over the years. It's been a remarkable situation. It was like Edmonton for all those years when Glenn Sather and the guys were running it with Grant Fuhr and Andy Moog and Billy Ranford and others. I mean, that's a pretty good run. Stabilizes your franchise.
So who's the best? I mean, I'll give you who's the top three goalies in the game today? Are they all Russian? Well, you look at Vasilevsky, Shesterkin. He's not Russian.
But
you said, are they all Russian? I'm like, well,
Hellebuck's a remarkable goalie, but he hasn't gotten over the hump yet. Like, Bobrovsky was a heck of a goalie. He never got over the hump. Now he's over the hump. So, yeah, I think those three are without question. The three, and I know all three of them work. You know, you think of the great goalies over the years, Dominik Hasek and Patrick Waugh. Patrick Waugh was a scientist. Mm-hmm. I remember talking to him about in the Stanley Cup Finals about a goal he let in, and he was mad because his glove, catching glove, was here, and the puck went up under the bar. He says, if my glove was there, that puck would have hit my glove, not gone under the bar. And I'm going, geez, when I played, I just happy to have my glove out there somewhere, let alone where it's supposed to be. You know, he was, and he worked at it. Dominik Hasek is one of the hardest working goalies I've ever seen. We used to go into games and get up there in the booth to broadcast. We'd count the shots he'd have in warm-up. And he let three or four in out of 120, whatever the numbers are. That's just how much and how he chased it, how much he wanted it.
And take breakaways and warm up. Who does that?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, for sure. Mike Richter, he was one of the last stand-up goalies, too. He was a side-to-side goalie, remarkably quick, great big thighs on him to be able to do that. It's like, you know, you have to go with what your strengths are. But the work habits have to be there for you as a goalie to become a great goalie. And I can tell you right now with Bobrovsky, because he was with us a long time in Columbus, it got to the point where he was a pain, because after games, if you had to rush out to head to the airport, he'd be the last guy out because he's still in there riding the bike and doing this and doing that and after the games. And then we're all sitting on the bus like this going, when's he coming? We got to go. You know, but give him credit, man. He's really developed into a winner, hardest working guy. He may be the hardest worker I've ever seen regarding goaltenders.
Okay. So you mentioned Mike Richter.
Yeah.
So we all know how great Mike Richter was. We saw him win the Stanley Cup for the Rangers in 94. He was a big part of the World Cup in 96 for the Americans. Yeah. Would Mike Richter get a chance to play goal in 2025? He's not very big. I mean, so when you talk about size, because size has become such a factor for the position.
Well, yeah. Bernie Perron's not playing.
When you talk about size, you automatically think height. It's also the length of your limbs, your arms and your legs. And a lot of teams and their goalie coaches, they want to find somebody that's got that. But I just, the big guys have had a lot of success because obviously the puck's going to hit you. You're bigger. But some of the guys that are a little bit shorter, I mean, the 6'1" guys, they're starting to look at them a little bit now again. And I'm not sure why, but they are. You look at Saros in Nashville, how well he's played. He's
Dustin
a great
Wolf
side-to-side goalie.
Dustin
Wolf in Calgary, yeah.
I'm going to be the devil's advocate.
Well, Bobrovsky's not real tall. What's he, 6'1"?
Yeah. Right?
You know, so it's a lot of it depends on how you play. I know we had Ian Clark as the goalie coach in Columbus, and when Bob got beat a little bit, and you know what, he'd be a little low, and they'd work the next day because I'd sit and watch it. Get higher, get your shoulders up, and he'd do it, and he'd be back being the star again. It depends how you play to deal with your body type.
I just wonder if a guy like Richter, who you know, yeah. after 2 years at the University of Wisconsin. Yeah. Would have even, and his goals against average was like 3.5 to almost a 4. Would he have even gotten a sniff in the NHL?
How tall was Andy Moog?
Yeah, but I don't think Andy Moog would get a sniff. I mean, that's kind of my point.
They were special. Mike Richter was special. He was really special.
I know. So you know as well as I do, when you sit in those scouting meetings, how big is he? You know, what's his wingspan?
No, that's fair. That's always gets brought up. The kid that went in the first round to San Jose, Ravensburger, I think that's his name. Yeah. He's a fairly tall kid. So, then there's tall guys like the Blue Jackets played Fedotov last night, who had belonged to Philadelphia. He's a 6'7" guy, he's still got to get over the hump. So it all depends. I think it's, if you're really good and you have that size, it's certainly helpful. But I still think there is room for the 6'1" guy. Once you get down to 5'11", it's hard. It's really hard.
Talent is like water. It will find a way eventually.
Yeah, if you have the will and the talent and that special spirit, you know, it's not gonna beat me. It's not gonna beat me. It's like a small forward to a degree. They shoot the puck a heck of a lot higher than they used to, even from the bad angles down on the goal line. They're trying to hit it off the side of your neck into the net. They never used to do that ever. But they sure do now, and maybe a little more size is helpful with that situation. It depends on how much you're down on your knees and how much you can keep your shoulders up and how much you battle. It's interesting.
Do you still watch the game through the eyes of a goaltender?
I think a lot. I like watching the game through the eyes of the goalie. And I mean, John's the one that taught me the two biggest words when you broadcast and watch is how and why. how and why. How did it happen and why did it happen? It doesn't always have to be negative either. It could be that guy made a hell of a play. That was a hell of a shot. But I also like to watch nuances of the game. I mean, matchups. If you think of defensemen that play a lot or forwards that are great, they're going against the other team's best. I've often said in baseball, the great pitchers can go 20, or, you know, say they get 20 wins and they have six losses. They generally are matched up against the other team's best pitcher. So that just tells you how good they really are. They really are. And to see great players, if I know that McKinnon's coming into Columbus, he's going to see a lot of Werenski. And if he finds his way to get a hat trick, that tells you how good this guy is. Or if Werenski shuts him down, he didn't shut down a third, fourth line guy. He shut down Nate McKinnon. Mm. So the greats are great. And when I watch games, I really enjoy watching that type of stuff. And I enjoy watching coaches try to change things up, whether they're winning or losing and what they're doing. And it's pretty scientific out there. It's very interesting. And there's a lot going on all the time.
And we're going to hear you and see you in the booth this year at any point?
Yeah. Actually, Jody Shelley, who does the analyst work with Columbus, is going to do 7 or 8 or something like that with up in Canada with Amazon. So I'm going to fill in and do those games. First one's in Edmonton on the November 10th, 9th, somewhere around there. So I'm really looking forward to it. I'm already watching reading all the Edmonton clips, trying to get it organized.
Okay, so just off to the right is that that yellow legal pad, is it?
Not just yet. It's up in my office.
The yellow legal pad, Darren. Yeah. You have to learn with JD. There's always on the coffee table in front of yellow legal pad.
I have such a bad memory. I got to write things down. Too many of those shots.
Well, you bring up those shots.
Yeah, look at that.
There's a couple of little gashes there and there. I can't imagine what that was like.
Look at that. You got Ken Dryden's over there. That's great. Yeah. Joe, you got Freeze. Joe Gratton's. You got Gratton's, the lion mask up there.
Yeah. Oh, Wayne my Thomas God. As well.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Have you guys got time for a quick Joe Gratton story?
Sure. Yes.
We're in New York, and we have a luncheon at Madison Square Garden with Ranger players and some of the Knicks and the high-profile sponsors. And it's hosted by Marv Albert, a great, great basketball announcer. So
we know him as Kenny Albertstead.
Yeah, there you go. And so they decide that they're going to ask some of the players some questions. So they get Joe Gratton up there, who was quite, I mean, this guy's a character. Holy smokes. They asked him why his nickname was the Count. He said, well, with his French accent, when I was in my last life, and he's dead serious, in my previous life, I used to be the Count. I would run the town where I grew up and over in Europe. And I had to take care of some stuff that was hard to take care of. But I had to stone some people and things like that. I was the Count. He says, but the God's getting me back. I'm a goaltender now, and they shoot pucks at me. He goes through this with his French accent, and he's dead serious. And these sponsors are sitting there, and they go, ooh, okay, I heard about goalies, but this one. But he... there was practices where they could take some shots from the blue line. He turned his back and catch it behind his back with his catching glove. He's an extremely talented guy. Classical pianist. I had a house that I rented in Long Beach, New York. He walked in, never even knocked, walked right in the house, dropped his coat in the middle of winter, went to the piano and started playing classical piano. Just an amazing guy. Very, very different.
How are you partners with him? Like,
I was in my department, but I did like him. I mean, it was interesting too. Everybody was driving the big Eldorados and the big fancy cars. He had a little Jetta, small little thing, and saved his money. And I think he bought, I'd heard now that he bought some Radio Shacks in Montreal and had done pretty well. So good for him. Good for him.
Wow. Frequency sometimes gets lost with goaltenders, but we do love going down that path. JD, thanks for the stories, reminiscing, outstanding. And we can't wait to tune into those games where you get back in the booth.
I appreciate it, guys. Have a great day and have a great season.
Thank you. The 70s were amazing for goaltenders, weren't they? Like when you go through the teams and 16 teams during that mid-70s, late-70s, and the legends that were in the league.
Well, you know, we haven't really talked much about Tony Esposito, who got traded from Montreal to Chicago and then became a superstar. And really, in many ways, Darren, the success of teams was based on how good their goaltending was. You know, Kenny in Montreal, Jokinen and Villemure with the Rangers, Eddie Johnson and Jerry Cheevers in Boston, Tony in Chicago. You know, the Leafs did not have consistently solid good goaltending in that period of time, and it reflects in what their record was.
Yeah, and for some reason, some teams just couldn't get it right.
Couldn't find it. Well, there is an irony that since Bernie and then the late Pelle Lindbergh, one of the biggest stories for the frustration of Flyer fans is consistent goaltending. Ron Hextall was really good.
Yeah, Ron Hextall gets overlooked too much there.
He does. And he won the Conn Smythe Trophy as a rookie. But you look at the revolving door, you know, the classic story is that, you know, the Flyers, that free agency summer, that they had a choice between Curtis Joseph and John Van Beesbrouck. And they signed Van Beesbrouck, and Curtis Joseph went to Toronto, and Toronto finally got solid goaltending. And John would, I think, privately admit he struggled in Philadelphia. And goaltending has been an issue for a long period of time for the Flyers. Even the sad story now of Carter Hart, you know, and what he's gone through and what the franchise has gone through by being forced to release him. So
there are some cities that are just hard on goaltenders more than others? We joke about it at times, but do you think it's real? Vancouver, I would put. Vancouver's goalie dungeons.
For the longest time, Detroit was hard on goalies.
Yes.
Detroit was really hard on goalies.
Tim Chevalier still having flashbacks, PTSD over that.
Sure. I do think that there are places where goaltending is always under a microscope. And yes, I think that there are some places that it's difficult to play the game.
All right. John Davidson mentioned Mike Richter and his thighs, and that was a true thing. Mike Richter had the biggest thighs. They were like your waist. It was freaky when you saw him after a game. Mm-hmm. I've never seen anything like it. So just to reiterate that, and the Bernie Perron story, I'm doing the Vegas Golden Knight expansion draft in 2017, T-Mobile Arena. I don't work for Vegas yet. And we're announcing the players that the Golden Knights have selected. And the National Hockey League has some of the top 100 players that they're mixing into the presentation of the awards. And Bernie Perron is helping present the Vezina Trophy. And he sees me backstage. He doesn't know who I am, but he just knows I've been out on stage doing some stuff. And comes up to me and says, "Hey, they want me to say craps. They want me to say crap. I can't say crap. I'm not going out there and saying crap." I'm like, "What?" He's like, "I can't say," and he says the bad word. "I'm not going to say poop," but I'm like, no, Bernie, they're not saying it's a gambling term. It's craps. They just want, it's a joke that they want you to say. "I'm not saying that." I'm like, "No, you're fine." So I convinced Bernie Perron to say craps before he goes out, and he walks away, and I thought, I'm not going to get this opportunity again. So I grab him by the shoulder, Bernie Perron, and put on my phone and take a selfie with him. But yeah, this conversation with Bernie Perron about saying crap in front of this arena is something that just is never unforgettable.
I was a kid of the 70s, loving every hockey game I could watch. And so when Bernie Perron made the cover of Time magazine, that to me was hockey was real. And the moment I heard yesterday that Bernie had passed away, the only picture that I went to find to post on social media was the Time magazine cover, because it meant so much. It meant so much to the game. It meant so much. I mean, the Broad Street Bullies were dominating the game of hockey, and Time magazine put a hockey goalie on its cover. And I thought that was the coolest thing. And I all these years later, every time I saw Bernie Parent, every time I talked to Bernie Parent, I only thought of the Time magazine cover.
He was so bubbly. His boat, the French Connection, he would live on it for 7 months. He loved fishing, absolutely loved fishing in the back. Oh, one more story. The outdoor game in Philadelphia, yep. The Rangers and the Flyers. And this is back when they did a lot of the alumni games on the day before the NHL regular season game. So it's the Flyers and the Rangers. 35 minutes before the puck drops for the alumni game, Bernie starting for the Philadelphia Flyers that day. Epic. We don't know when the last time Bernie's been on the ice. He's late 60s. And Mr. Snyder goes into the Rangers room and starts, and it gets quiet as it would. And all these Ranger legends are there. And Mr. Snyder thanks them. Appreciate you guys coming out. Want to have a great day. It's amazing, this great rivalry, and now we get to have some fun with it. Bernie is starting today. Nobody scores on Bernie and then walks out. Nick Kyprios is in the room, so I got that straight from him. Nobody scores on Bernie, and away they go. And Ron Duguay had a chance and let a pretty good shot go, and Bernie stopped him left after 3 or 4 minutes.
Well, as we talked about with John, I mean, that Flyer team transcended sports. And in a city that size, the Flyers were elevated to a level like the other big three sports. And I've never,
I think they're close
that.
To getting it back. They got some momentum with Tocket going back.
They do. And they got a new arena coming, Darren. They got another new arena coming, but
Michkov could be a star.
Yeah. Yeah, but they've got to start winning some more. That's a tough challenge for Danny Briere and Rick and Keith Jones.
Got a bit of their DNA back. I like it.
But you know what? But the DNA always was that the Flyers were tough. Mm. Look at the penalty minutes in the last 5 years.
Rebuild, though.
30th, 31st, 32nd. It's crazy. Mm.
But Couturier also said it best. I've had more good conversations with Rick Tocchet in 3 months than I had with John
there.
Tortorella.
We're trying to get Torts on the show. Don't go there.
I'll ask him. I love Torts.
Me too.
I absolutely love him, but he's got that approach.
Yeah.
There's nothing. My conversations with John are unbelievable, but he would still scare me. Just like you.
I don't scare you. Come on.
Frightened right now. I gotta go. Let us know what you think about these stories from John Davidson. Please rate the podcast, give us a good thumbs up, and we get it to more people as we roll on into this season of the National Hockey League's 2025-26 campaign.
Roll on, huh?
Roll on.